Good morning, and yeah, we're all ready. Welcome to week five. First of all, just to point out that besides today, there's another 2 weeks of this particular series. Although for resilience, probably there's never enough weeks, but for now we'll stop. So we're going to do another 2 weeks on this topic. The week after that, I should just point out, the week after that is the 24th of March. It's also Purim. It's a Thursday this year, like last year. And as Purim is on a Thursday, so we will actually still have the session. We'll do a special one, as we always do. Have a bit of a morning tea and do a special topic related to Purim. So please come along. So put in your diary the 24th of March. That's the Thursday, 24th of March. That's Purim. But for the resilience series, another 2 weeks besides today. Okay, so we're working through resilience on many levels. We've talked about choosing resilience as a choice. Talking about finding and accessing the spark that's at the very core of our existence that gives us the ability to exercise resilience. We had a discussion about persistence, not being put off by setbacks, having a determination, wanting to win, not resigning ourselves to being victimized, and so on and so forth. Last week, just to summarize a little bit, last week we talked about a general mindset as a support to resilience. Even when things are going okay, just the normal little annoying things of every day, we talked about having just a general mindset of positivity and optimism, which when we develop that kind of mindset and that becomes part of our general personality, then when things really challenging happen, it becomes a lot easier to engage and explore the concept of resilience. And the two things we talked about last week were, first of all, the idea of challenging our negative beliefs and our negative thinking. We did the ABCDE formula, the A being adversity, something challenging happens. The B then is the belief, how we interpret it, what we believe is the cause of it, and so on, which is often negative. And then the consequence, which is how we react. And we talked about the concept of challenging that by the D and the E. The D is disputation, challenging our thoughts, challenging our beliefs, challenging the way we interpret things, and then leading to the E, which is energization. So we challenge it by challenging the evidence. Who said we got all the facts right? Who said we're judging it right? Who said our perspective is the accurate one? Maybe there's alternatives, maybe there's different ways of thinking, and just generally what the use of hanging on to negative beliefs would be. And the second thing we talked about is just generally building a mindset of positivity through the concept of optimism and through the concept of building a paradigm of gratitude, noticing the good things that are often not noticed, not falling prey to the concept of habit, where we just take the things for granted that we expect to happen every single day, but rather learning and practicing more than learning of how to identify every single day the small things that we take for granted and recognize the gifts that we have every day, and looking for the positive even where there seems to be more negative. Before we go on, I want to just clarify something. When I talked about positive thinking last week, so we were not referring to, and I just want to make that clear, what they call today positive affirmations, which is a type of strategy where they talk about when you wake up in the morning of playing all these positive messages in your mind, which not necessarily is always a bad thing. But sort of statements like when you feel lonely to say, you know, I take pleasure in my own loneliness or solitude, or I love myself, I approve myself. In other words, convincing yourself of positive things. Or when someone is terrified to wake up in the morning and say, I make choices every day, or I trust myself, or these kind of things. Right? Waking up and saying, this day will bring nothing but joy, which might not be the case, by the way, because this day actually might bring some challenging things. But the reason I say that is because it's not as simple as that. What I was talking about last week is much deeper than that. What I was talking about is challenging the way we think. It's very different. In other words, being aware of the negative beliefs and thoughts that we have and challenging them. In other words, reinterpreting the facts, going through in our minds different alternatives of how we can understand what is going on in our experiences and trying to reframe, as we talked about a few weeks ago, the things that we see or the things we experience from something being more negative to something being more positive. So it's a much deeper way of positive thinking. It's actually challenging and noticing those things which are already good. That's the second thing we spoke about. But in terms of negative thoughts, actually challenging the way we think and reinterpreting and reframing it so that we can understand it in a much more positive context. What I do want to mention, however, is this, that where that concept sort of does work, where we force ourselves to do things that we don't feel, is not so much in messages, but it's more in action. There is a concept, I want to just quickly mention that. There's a Jewish principle that teaches us that the heart follows the action. Feelings follow the action. This is talked about, I've mentioned it before, this is talked about one of the great writers called the Sefer HaChinuch. And he writes, in fact, about a parsha, the weekly parsha of a few weeks ago, where he talks about the priests wearing special clothing. And that special clothing is designed to give them a special mindset and a feeling of commitment and subservience and reverence when they work in the temple. So it brings a certain consciousness and a certain emotional sort of mindset. And he says, what's the concept behind it? And the concept is he develops this idea, which we call in Hebrew, Acharei ha-ma'asim nimshach ha-levavot, which means after action follows the heart. That although we often talk about that the mind guides the heart and then the heart inspires action, but it can work the other way around. What we can do is when we do something positive, we become positive. So that does work. In other words, sometimes when we're feeling down and we're feeling negative, to do something positive, just to say, listen, I'm just going to do something, I'm going to help someone, I'm going to do something positive. It's like when you walk into a wedding and you're not particularly in a happy mood, but you join the dance floor, it does have an effect on the heart as well. When you start dancing, you become happy. For most people, that is. I hope. I mean, you know, got to clarify things. There's always exceptions to the rule. So in terms of thinking, it's more about challenging our thinking and trying to work out different interpretations, a different reframing exercise of how we can interpret and experience things in a more positive context. In terms of action, it does work just to force ourselves to do things which are more positive. Okay, today I want to tackle and explore a topic which I think is critical to the concept of resilience, but needs to be understood properly. It can be open to misinterpretation, and I'll tell you later why. But it is a critical, critical idea in terms of how to experience resilience. And that's the concept of what I call meaning and purpose. Now, I need to develop this a little bit slowly and talk about it, and then find its relevance and connection to the concept of this idea of resilience. And to talk about what does it mean to find meaning and purpose in every stage and in every part of what we experience. So let's just take this in a few stages, and we need to start with a bit of theory so we understand how we experience this whole idea. So we know that central to Jewish belief, of course, if we have a look at Jewish fundamentals and what things we understand, is that in every existence there's a purpose. In other words, we exist not by accident. We exist not just to enjoy life. Nothing wrong in enjoying life, but we exist not just to enjoy the things that we're given, but we exist in this planet, on this planet, for a meaning, for a purpose, for a mission. So the idea is that we don't live a life of emptiness, a life of just pursuit of emptiness and pleasure, but we live a life where there's a plan, there's a purpose. Now, that purpose is a multi-layered purpose. There's a general purpose that we all have, to grow as human beings, to make the world a better place, to bring God into our lives and into the world through the study of Torah, through performance of various mitzvot that God has given us, whether they're mitzvot between man and man or man and God, and just generally to connect to something higher, something deeper, something greater than ourselves. Now, that's a general thing, and God, in Jewish thought, we have a formula. It's called the Torah. God gives us a formula and a moral code and a moral compass of how we navigate the various challenges of life and how we bring meaning and purpose to every day and our life, our general life experience. However, in the context of that general formula, we also, of course, believe that there's a specific mission that everyone has. Everyone has a bit of a different mission within that context. So, for example, we have this concept, Kabbalistically, where in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, Aaron, the first high priest, was given the mitzvah of kindling the menorah, right? Kindling the candelabra. Again, we just had this. In fact, we have it in this week's parasha as well. And the kindling of the menorah goes like this. God said that in the temple they had to build this beautiful golden candelabra. And the candelabra had to have... Please come in. There's plenty of place. Please. Come in. The candelabra had to have 7 branches. But here was the interesting thing. It had to have 7 branches, 7 candles. Often confused, by the way, with the Hanukkah menorah, which has 8. But the temple one had 7. And the Kohen, the priest, would kindle it every night. But although the menorah had 7 branches, it actually had to be made out of 1 piece of solid gold. So it wasn't different components put together. It was actually 1 piece of solid gold. What's the idea? The idea, Kabbalistically, we are taught that the candles represent the soul. Right? Candles are always compared to a soul. The candle of God is the soul of man, it says in the verse. And therefore, Aaron the Kohen, when he would kindle the menorah every day, it was a process of infusing each soul with inspiration and energy to pursue their mission. So the Torah tells us that the menorah was made out of 1 piece of solid gold, but yet there were 7 branches. Why? Because the 1 piece of solid gold represents the general mission which we all subscribe to, the principles, the values, the fundamentals which are generic to all of us. And yet there are 7 separate branches because everyone has their specific mission, a specific goal in life. This one focuses more on helping people. This one focuses more on study. This one focuses more on whatever the mission is. But there's room and necessity for individuality in the pursuit of the mission and purpose throughout our life journey. And that's an important thing. Then, of course, we break it down further that it's not only every person, but it's every day. Every day has its purpose. Every day has its mission. Every hour has its purpose. And so on. And that's how we live our life. So fundamental, as I say, to Jewish thought is this concept that every day has a purpose. Every day can be filled with meaning, an opportunity to live our values, to grow as human beings, and to pursue our life mission statements. Now, interesting thing is that this is an old Jewish concept, of course, fundamental to Jewish thought from when the Torah was given. However, today in more modern psychological literature, this has now been well documented and very, very much spoken about in great depth. And they talk about the depth and the benefits that are there for a person who lives a life of meaning. You remember, we once did a whole series on The Good Life by Hugh Mackay. It was based on that concept. But many, many, many therapists and researchers are now writing about it and talking about that when people have a life, a purpose, a higher purpose in life, a meaning in life, suddenly there's a tremendous linkage to greater happiness, to stress reduction, to all kinds of interesting benefits that come from living a life that is not empty and that are not hedonistic and not materialistic, but just a life of greater meaning and purpose. Now, of course, one of the early ones to write on this in more contemporary times, as we're going to refer to him in a few moments again, is Viktor Frankl, who developed the whole concept of logotherapy and wrote the book, the bestseller book, Man's Search for Meaning. And this was the foundation of his thesis. And he talked about using the concept of pursuit of meaning to endure challenging times. And the famous line, I'm going to come back to his thoughts in a moment, but the famous line that he puts there in his book, he says that those who have a why to live can bear almost any how. Amazing line. Those that have a why to live can bear almost anyhow. Now, we need to understand what that means, but that's what he says. There's a psychologist called Barbara Fredrickson, and she did a whole bunch of research with the whole team, and she talked about that people who got happiness or pleasure from external things, right? People who have happy life, but the happiness comes rather from externalities like pleasure or having more and so on and so forth, actually never brings a reduction of things like stress and depression and anxiety. Whereas people who live a life of meaning, or people who get pleasure and fulfillment, inner fulfillment, out of pursuing purpose and depth and meaning, it actually scientifically now researched, it's linked to things like stress reduction, lower depression rates, anxiety, longevity, all these different types of things. It's quite an amazing body of research that has come out of this whole understanding, this whole exploration of this concept of meaning and purpose. Interesting that Roy, I don't know how to pronounce the name exactly, but Baumeister or something, in 1991, he did a research study and concluded that living a life of meaning has to also be linked, and I mention this because obviously there's an incredibly Jewish concept, this has to also be linked to a certain structure and commitment and action. In other words, meaning is insufficient if it's just meaning in your heart. It's got to be meaning linked to a structure, a ritual type of life where you actually have structure and commitment and you have ways that you behave which are in line with those values. And he said, then that brings a greater depth, greater benefit, greater benefits, and strengthening of relationships, interestingly enough. Now, I mean, it's very fascinating because today we have, today in today's world, we've mentioned this before, today this is often misunderstood. Today we live in a world where there's so much available and there's so much that people have, which is a good thing. Everyone should always have what they need and more, but the focus becomes so much on pleasure, on pursuit of physical pleasure and emptiness. And we are seeing a direct proportion. I mean, there's an epidemic proportion rise today in depression and anxiety and all these different related diseases, which is alarming. I just read a study this morning. I was reading something about resilience for children, actually. And they were talking about this. I've forgotten exactly the percentage, but the staggering amount of percentage of children now and adolescents who are experiencing clinical depression, which is just, it's out of control. And I think a lot of it definitely has to do with this concept of what is there some meaning? Is some higher purpose in life, which brings in turn some inner fulfillment? And that inner fulfillment is directly linked to reducing the concept of these types of things like anxiety and depression, which is an amazing thing. Now, let's go back to Viktor Frankl's book, The Man's Search for Meaning. So the background is, I'm sure you're all familiar, Viktor Frankl was a psychologist, psychiatrist before the war broke out in Vienna. A leading one. The war broke out, he landed up in a concentration camp being Jewish. And it's there where he developed much further his whole theory, and he developed this idea of logotherapy, of man's search. I thought the renovations were bad, but okay. man's search for a meaningful life, right? Now, in his book, there are two very, very important foundations that come out. The first one, and this is something that he says he discovered in the camp, which you can't get a more adverse and negative environment than that, of course. He said that he realized that in any situation, no matter how adverse and how bad it is, ultimately it's a person's choice whether to lose their dignity or not. In other words, ultimate freedom, he explained in his book, observing what he observed in the camps, and experiencing what he experienced, which he then credits his survival to that whole mindset that he developed during his time in the camps, that man's freedom ultimately is inside. In other words, although you cannot change, which we've talked about many times in different ways, although you cannot change the things that happened around you, and there's no control in his context of the Nazis taking away your clothes and reducing you to a number and treating you with incredible disrespect, that's a mild word, I suppose, but they were trying, and their whole purpose was to dehumanize the human and to treat them like an insect. But he said at the end of the day, he realized that if for him to feel that way would be completely his choice. They could do whatever they want to him, but they can't take away his own feeling. They can't take away his own choice. And therefore, he made that choice, no matter what he looked like on the outside, no matter what they did to him on the outside, he made that choice and inspired many others to make that choice not to feel that way and to decide and to choose their own response. But then he went on to say, how do you do that? And where do you take that to? And that's where he goes to the whole concept of man's search for meaning, which he develops in the book in great detail. I'm just going to quote a couple of the things he says. But what he explains is that actually, although many of us wouldn't admit it, and although today we have millions of people that will claim that they don't feel that way, but in essence, it's actually at the core essence of every human being. The foundation of the human being, he says, is the desire, the will, the absolute yearning for inner fulfillment, for purpose, for meaning, for depth. Which, by the way, he got into large trouble for before the war and afterwards, because he was actually a very significant break from what was then modern psychology or Freudian psychology, who believed that the essence of the human being is some crazy monkey who has some sort of desires of got to do with sexuality. And he disputed that. It was a very, very big shift. His shift was that the core of the human being is actually not that. The core of the human being is this deep desire and this deep yearning to live a life of meaning and purpose. Incidentally, after the war, his book almost didn't get published. and his whole faculty almost got closed down because there was such opposition. Such opposition. I don't know why. Maybe the opposition was because it brings a lot of responsibility. See, this idea, once you realize it, it's an amazing revelation, but it comes with a lot of responsibility and it comes with work. It comes with effort. It's a lot easier just to follow your desires of pleasure. It's harder, but much more fulfilling to follow a life of purpose. Right? So he got into massive strife and he almost did, but at the end he prevailed. Interesting enough, it's another story. I think I did once tell you the story, but it's actually interesting. He almost moved to Australia after the war because he had a sister that lived there. And he was going to give up psychology. Anyway, at the end he didn't, and he became the famous Viktor Frankl with the bestseller of Man's Search for Meaning, thank God. But because he inspired many millions of people and inspired many, many other ways of thinking, like, for example, Stephen Covey's Seven Habits is largely based on Viktor Frankl's work and so on and so forth. But his work, I quote it a lot because it's very, very deeply in sync with Jewish thought, of course, right? Because that is the Jewish view that every man is born with a desire to serve God, as it's called, to bring greater value and meaning and purpose to life, to grow as a human being, and to make the world a better place. Therefore, he says the following. He said, because this is the essence of the human being, therefore it becomes possible in every situation, and it becomes possible even in situations of unavoidable suffering. Okay, this is his next link, and this is where it becomes important. He says, meaning comes from within, not from without. And therefore, because you choose what your meaning will be, or you choose to have meaning, you choose to strive for purpose, that choice, that yearning, that way of thinking, and then ultimately way of living, does not come from the outside, it comes from within you. And because it comes from within you, it is possible even in the case of unimaginable suffering, which is unavoidable sometimes. You follow what I'm saying? In other words, to live comfortably, to have pleasure, to be comfortable in a physical sense, which isn't a bad pursuit, by the way. We don't look for suffering, we're going to talk about that in a moment. But to be comfortable ultimately, only to be able to cope and to thrive when I'm in a situation or a context of physical comfort that is external. I need the externalities to work for that. I need the day to go okay. I need the air conditioning to work. I need the parking spaces to be available. I need to be healthy. I need there to be food on the table. I need lots of things. If that's the sole foundation of my coping mechanism. But if my pursuit of life, he explains, is the desire for meaning, it's to give meaning to whatever situation, it's to understand that every hour has a calling, every moment has a calling to live a hour of purpose and depth, which comes from within, not from without, then no matter what the without is, I'm able to give it meaning. Now, is that clear? Yeah. Now, I want to just clarify something which he clarifies. I think it's so important to clarify this. Because I say it a lot of times, but I say it for a reason a lot of times, because I don't want it ever to be misinterpreted. Number one, we don't ask for suffering. Number two, as he puts it, he said, but let me make it perfectly clear that in no way is suffering necessary to find meaning. Right? That's not the intention of what we're talking about. It is possible, even in suffering, and sometimes suffering calls out or reveals an inner strength which makes the person much stronger than they were before, but it doesn't mean that meaning depends on suffering, God forbid. We daven, we pray every day not to suffer. We pray every day for tragedy and challenge not to happen. Nor do we mean, and I've made this clear the first time, but I'm making it clear again because I think it's important, that when a person experiences, God forbid, challenge or suffering or negative experience, that one shouldn't feel the pain and one shouldn't feel upset. Absolutely not. We know that in Jewish thought, as we've said many, many times, we have to grieve and we have to acknowledge the pain and we have to acknowledge the negativity of the situation. We cannot go into denial. That's not part of meaning and purpose. What we are talking about is that with feeling the pain and with experiencing the negative and giving time to experience it and to express it properly, we are able to bounce back and we're able to choose our response ultimately because we understand that even that kind of situation is one that can be meaningful and purposeful, notwithstanding the negativity, notwithstanding the suffering, notwithstanding the challenge. He tells a beautiful story in his book. He says about part of the time in the camp where he came to this realization on his own. He said that he came to the camp with his manuscript of his first manuscript of his book, which he tried to hide in his, naively I suppose, in his garments. And then he says that when they stripped him and they took away his clothes and it all got disappeared, he thought everything was lost. And then he looked around and he just, for a moment or for a period of time, became despondent. And he realized that the chance of survival was very slim. He realized that he had lost what he calls his own child, meaning his brainchild, his own work, the work that he put into so many years to developing this theory of logotherapy, the early manuscripts of it, that he now had lost, and it was his life work. When suddenly he felt in the clothes that were given to him, there was a pocket, and the pocket he felt there was a piece of paper. And he took out the piece of paper and he saw that it was a torn piece from a siddur, a prayer book, and on it was the verse Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. And he said, how should have I interpreted such a coincidence, in inverted commas, other than as a challenge to live my thoughts instead of merely putting them on paper? In other words, it was at that moment that he said he had lost his manuscripts, but that had now become a turning point for him, where instead of having the manuscripts on paper, it was now time for him to put his thoughts that were previously on paper into his mind and to his heart and to live them. And to understand that even where, in the context that he was in, experiencing what he was experiencing, he was able to give it meaning and purpose somehow. Now, he used to say, Viktor Frankl, he'd say the following. He would say that the way we find meaning is not to ask what we want from life. Instead, we should ask what life wants from us. We are each, he said, unique in our gifts, our abilities and skills and talents, in our circumstances of life. For each of us, then, there is a task only we can do. This is an amazing idea. In other words, this goes back to what I said before. Besides the general mission and purpose we all have, there are certain things that only we can do. There are certain things that God wants us to do. When we find ourselves in any situation, good or bad, the purpose, the mission, the values that I have to experience that day, and the meaning that I have to bring to human existence on that particular day, is only something I can do. It's something only my candle can do that God wants me to do. And Rabbi Sacks, in one of his articles where he quotes Viktor Frankl, he links this to this concept of a calling. He links this to this idea of a pasuk, a verse which we're going to read in the Torah portion in a couple of weeks, where God, every time God speaks to Moses, we have the phrase Vayikra El Moshe. He called Moses. And calling Moses, not just calling Moses to speak to him, but calling represents a calling. In other words, as Viktor Frankl used to say, life is a task. The man who seeks meaning differs from the one who doesn't by experiencing his existence not simply as a task, but as a mission. He or she is aware of being summoned or called by a source. And he ends, he says, for thousands of years, that source has been called God. This is very much linked to a beautiful story I'll just share with you quickly. The story of the first Chabad Rebbe called the Alter Rebbe. And he lived in Russia, in Tsarist Russia. And he was jailed. The famous story, he was jailed for 53 days. And the reason he was jailed is because he had lots of opponents. And there were people who were out to sort of take him down. And they spread libels against him that he was fighting the government. The background of the story was an interesting one. He was sending money to Israel. He talks a lot in his book of the Tanya about the importance of supporting Israel. It's a good time to talk about that now around the UIA time. But about supporting Israel and about sending money to help people in Israel. And he did that. The problem was at that time, Israel was under Turkish rule. And Turkey and Russia were enemies. So word got to the Russian government that he's supporting the enemy. Nothing to do with Turkey, of course. It had to do with the Jews living in the poorer parts of Israel. But that was the con. Anyways, he landed up in jail. When he was in jail, he was interrogated a lot about his whole mission, about what he stood for. It's a very, very detailed, long story. But he was very impressive on the stand, and he was very intellectual, and they got to realize that they're not dealing here with a simple person. They're dealing with quite an intellectual, a tzaddik, a holy person. So there was a great dignitary, very close to the Tsar, who decided he needs to see for himself who this guy is. He's a very knowledgeable, non-Jewish guy, who came incognito one day to the Alter Rebbe's cell to visit him. And he said to the Alter Rebbe, I understand you're a bit of a scholar. To Rav Shneur Zalman, he said, I understand you're a bit of a scholar, and I'd like to ask you a question. I'm also a scholar. I love to study Bible with its commentaries, and I'd like to ask you a question. Rav Shneur Zalman said, with pleasure. And he said, the following question is as follows. He said, in the very beginning of Genesis, after Adam and Eve ate from the forbidden fruit, so they were embarrassed and they hid, it says, and then God called to them. And it said, God called to Adam, and he said to him, Ayeka, where are you? Where are you? So he said, he doesn't know. He doesn't understand. If God is all powerful and God knows everyone's thoughts, surely God knew where Adam was hiding. I mean, come on, like. So Rav Shneur Zalman said, it's a very good question. But there's a great commentator called Rashi, he addresses the question. And he says that God didn't want to frighten Adam, so he wanted to engage him in polite conversation first before he hits him over the head for eating the fruit. So therefore, he said to him, where are you, as a means to just to introduction, introducing the conversation. So the guy was a very knowledgeable guy. He says, look, I'm aware of that answer. I know Rashi. I've studied Rashi. I know that he says that answer. I'd like to know something else. Can you tell me something else? So at that point, Rav Shneur Zalman became very serious. He said, I'll tell you what the deeper meaning of this word is. When God called to Adam, to the first human being, Ayeka, and he asked him, where are you? It wasn't a question only for Adam. It was an eternal, perpetual question that God keeps on asking every single person, every single day. Ayeka, where are you? What are you doing with your life? Where are you holding, as we say? Where are you up to? Where are you up to in the journey of growth? And he went on, as the story concludes, he went on to say, for example, God takes a person who is a certain age, and he mentioned this person's age, and he has a family, and he has a number of children. He told him exactly how many children he had, and the guy was blown away. Alter Rebbe was a tzaddik, had a bit of divine inspiration. And he asks you, he says, what are you doing with your life? Where are you? What meaning and purpose are you giving to your life? And that's the essence of that concept of the pursuit of meaning. The idea is that we're in this world for a purpose, and to live a life of values, to live a life of purpose, which comes from inside. We understand that there's a calling. We understand that every single day, every single hour, every single moment, there's a question, a calling, as Viktor Frankl called it, from God to us, Ayeka, as in that story, where are you? Where are you? Where are you up to with your meaning? And therefore, that becomes the beginning of this discussion. It becomes the first mechanism to understand that even in times of negativity, with their trouble, with their pain, with their suffering, but somehow we have to be able to ignite that spark within us, because we have a pursuit of meaning. And because meaning means that you can give every part of life meaning, and you can channel the experiences of every part of life into some sort of transformative journey and pursuit of finding purpose and meaning, no matter how negative and how difficult the situation are. It doesn't mean, by the way, that we ask why. Meaning, it doesn't mean that we understand why we're experiencing what we're experiencing. And I've mentioned this many times. We don't. We don't understand what God does much of the time. Nor does He want us to understand, nor does He want us to find answers. He wants us to remain with the question, because He wants us to hope for better times. He wants us to be positive, and He wants us to dive in for good times. But while the negativity is happening, for reasons beyond us, what we do know is that we can respond. What we do know is that we can respond from within to find meaning and purpose, because there's a calling of today. I can't say I'm going to wait till I feel better in 3 years from now, because that's a different calling. That's a different meaning. There's a meaning and purpose that's needed today. And therefore, that's critical to the whole concept and process of resilience, because when we understand that inside of us, at our very core, we have this pursuit of meaning, then it gives us that push to say, okay, I am suffering. I acknowledge that I'm suffering. But how can I change this around? How can I look forward now to finding meaning and purpose in what I'm doing? Let me give you a couple of thoughts which sort of emphasize this whole idea. There's a story in the Talmud. I'm sure somewhere along the line I must have mentioned the story before, but a fascinating story. After the destruction of the Second Temple, under terrible Roman oppression, great Rabbi Akiva, who was, by the way, I suppose a bit like King David that I mentioned a few weeks ago, Rabbi Akiva in his time was also the master of resilience. Rabbi Akiva went with a few of his colleagues down to Jerusalem, and they visited the Temple Mount. And as they came close to the Temple Mount, as Jewish law states, some people even do this today when they see still, even though we have Jerusalem and we have the Temple Mount and we have the Western Wall, but it's still incomplete, still in foreign hands, a lot of it, and still Mashiach hasn't come, we don't have a temple. So Jewish law says you're supposed to tear kriya. When you come close, because of the, see the suffering, you see that it's exile, you tear your garments. And they did that. It says they all tore their garments as they came close to Temple Mount. And when they came close to the Kodesh, the Hara Maria, the Temple Mount, and those days they were very well aware exactly where the temple stood. It was still in ruins from the destruction. They saw an animal, a fox, coming out of the spot of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, the holiest spot in the temple, the place where only the high priest, the holiest person, would go in only once a year on the holiest day. Total desolation, total destruction. It was a symbol of absolute devastation. So naturally, Rabbi Akiva's colleagues started to cry. And Rabbi Akiva started to laugh. So his colleagues looked at him, Mazeh, why are you crying? Sorry, why are you laughing? They said to him. So he said to them, and why are you crying? These were all very great people, by the way. So they said, what do you mean, why are we crying? The place upon which it says that no man, no human being shall ever go there, because it's so holy, with the exception of the high priest, once a year on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, and now foxes are roaming there and we shouldn't cry? You serious? Like, this is the ultimate symbol of desolation, of destruction, of persecution? So he said, that's why I'm laughing. And he quoted two verses, which are juxtaposed. The one talks about the destruction of Jerusalem that will befall the Jewish people. The other one talks about how ultimately there will be a rebuilding, and there will come a time where there will be old men and women in the streets of Jerusalem, and brides and grooms will be rejoicing, and ultimately there will be a third temple. And he said, the way I look at it is, when I see the destruction, now you have to understand what this means. Rabbi Akiva himself also tore his garments. He knew there was destruction. He says, when I see the destruction, I see the fulfillment of the first prophecy, I know that we're on the road towards the second prophecy. I know we're looking forward now to the rebuilding. And I've often thought about this piece of the Talmud, and I think that the reason that we understand this passage is because both perspectives are true. The reason that the Talmud tells us the story is because we have to incorporate both perspectives. When we suffer tragedy, when we suffer challenge, or when we go through a difficult time, we do cry. And we should cry. We should feel the pain because that's normal. And we should give our emotions the opportunity to express them properly. And we should be healthy people, and healthy people means to acknowledge pain and to express grief and to express all the various emotions that need to be expressed. That is very normal and very necessary. People who go through very, very tough times without crying, it's often a problem because we need to express it. But at the same time, we need to know that we have the spark within us, like Rabbi Akiva, to then start laughing, meaning start laughing to understand, doesn't mean to laugh like a joke. It means to laugh, to smile, to understand, to look forward, to say, okay, it is suffering, it is difficult, but how can I give this meaning? How can I bring hope into this situation? How can I bring purpose and depth into this very desolate and devastating environment? And you know, for this reason, there's an amazing concept which we find in the Chumash, which here, once again, I want to quote Rabbi Sacks because he points this out in the most beautiful little chapter of his book called Future Tense. You know, when Moses was at the burning bush, this was a very, very important moment. When Moses was at the burning bush, and that's when God revealed himself to him, and he told him to go down to Egypt. And he said to him, the suffering of the Jewish people I am aware of, and time has come to redeem them. And I want to send you down to redeem the Jewish people. Right? This is with the time that Moses actually argued with God. He didn't want to become the leader of the Jewish nation. Another discussion. But he debated God, and eventually God prevailed, of course, and he became the great leader of the Jewish nation. In the debate which Moses has with God at the burning bush, he says to God, but you're sending me to Egypt to a persecuted people, and I'm going to tell them, you know, there's this God who sent me to redeem you. They're going to say, who is God? Like, what's his name? You know, a couple of credentials. Like, what's his CV? What's his name? And God answers, and it's on your handout in English. God answers, tell them, Ehaye Asher Ehaye. Normally translated as, I am who I am. Meaning, simple translation, or simple meaning that is, that I have no name. God is above names, I'm above description, like the Midrash says. names are descriptive, names are limiting. God said to Moses, according to the Midrash, in the Oral Torah, God says, it depends what I'm doing. I'm actually above description, so therefore it depends what I choose to be doing at the time. If I'm waging a war, this is my name. If I'm kind, this is my name. If I'm redeeming the Jewish people, I have a different name. We know there's seven names of God and so on and so forth. But otherwise, just tell him, I am who I am. But he points out an amazing thing. He says that if you look in translations of the Chumash, non-Jewish or even Jewish translations, you get different translations of this phrase. I am who I am what I am, that is who I am. All the translations up until now seem to translate that phrase in the present tense. But it's actually a mistranslation. If you know a little bit of Hebrew, you know it's a mistranslation. The word Eheyeh means I will be, future tense. Eheyeh asher Eheyeh means I will be who I will be. And he says an amazing concept. He says the foundation of the Jewish nation, the survival of the Jewish nation, the miraculous resilience which we have as a people, not just as individuals, is based on one thing. It's based on looking forward and not back. Fundamental to the Jewish experience is that we learn from the past, but we don't get stuck in the past. We learn from the past, but we move forward. What we experience now just becomes a foundation to understand what can I do about it going forward. What meaning and purpose, okay, I've experienced a negative thing. I've suffered a loss. I've gone through a terrible time and I feel the pain. But I need to now move forward. I need to look forward. God says to Moses, go tell the Jewish people that they've been persecuted for 210 years but this, and they're going to question you. And it's not just about asking for God's CV. The reason that the Jewish people are going to question you is because they've lost hope, as the Chumash tells us later. They don't believe that as a persecuted people for 210 years, and particularly for the last 86 years of Egypt, which were devastating and terrible persecution, they don't believe they can move forward. They don't believe they can be redeemed. And they're going to ask you, who is this? Who is this God that all of a sudden brings us hope and can tell us that we're going to be redeemed and move towards Mount Sinai and become a nation and so on and so forth? Tell them the secret is, Eheyeh asher Eheyeh. The secret is I'm a future God, meaning I'm one that focuses on the future, not to get stuck in the past. Eheyeh, I will be who I will be. Tell them to look forward. You know that the Chumash tells us an unbelievable story that when Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, another story, and Abraham's nephew was saved by the angels. Right? This story has many interpretations, but this is one of them. And they were saved with the angels that were sent to Abraham, later went to Sodom and Gomorrah and saved Lot and his family. But the instruction was that when you leave the city, and the city, because there was a terrible immoral city and God decided to destroy them, that they weren't permitted to look back. And the story goes that Lot's wife looked back and she turned into a pillar of salt. Right? You're aware of that Midrashic story. And one of the interpretations is that if you want to move on, you can't look back. If you get stuck in the back, you're not redeemed. You can't escape. Lot's wife looked back, she got stuck. You move forward, you don't look back, then you can. You learn from the past, but we don't get stuck in the past. If you go back to Rabbi Akiva for a moment, I want to show you a beautiful thing. You know, Rabbi Akiva, he didn't just laugh. He put this into practice. How so? He put this into practice because Rabbi Akiva was one of the greatest sages, Talmudic sages that ever lived. But if you know anything about his history, you know, it's interesting. I remember when I was a student in Yeshiva, and later I realized this problem. When you study Talmud, you study Jewish law in depth. An analytical law, you go and you delve into the concepts, you learn about great people and great sages who were masters of thought and philosophy and Jewish law. But the Talmud is not a book of history. For a history book, you have to read other literature. It's only later I realized that it's fascinating to put together the personalities of the Talmud to the personalities in their lifetime. And when you read about Rabbi Akiva, he's such an unbelievable Talmudic sage, and then you marry it with the fact that he lived an incredibly suffering life. He lived a life of unbelievable. He was in the intense moment period of Roman rule. He was persecuted beyond. At the end of his life, he was tortured beyond. And yet, the Talmud says an amazing thing about him. He was so amazing in Jewish law and interpreting the Torah and the written Torah that it says, if you turn over your handout to, this is where I put it, if you turn over your hand to this side, right? This is the font. I just want to share this with you. It's an amazing thought. This is a font. The way it's in the Torah itself, in the actual Torah, right? These are the letters, the way they're Torah. Now you'll notice that a lot of the letters have these little crowns on top, right? They have different names. Sometimes they're called tagin. Tagin is an Aramaic word for crowns. But sometimes they're also called like a kotz, like a thorn. like because they're shaped like a thorn. They stick out like a thorn, right? And there's certain letters, like you see the Gimel, the Tet, the Zion, and so on, they have to have these things. But we are taught, they're not just there for aesthetics. We are taught that every crown, every little thing on the letter actually has deep meaning. There's hidden meanings and hidden laws and hidden Torah principles that are in each of these little crowns. Not everyone is able to recognize them, but Rabbi Akiva was. And the Talmud tells us about Rabbi Akiva that, listen to the words in Hebrew, and I'll translate them, that I'll call kotz v'kotz on every thorn, meaning on every little one of these crowns, he was able to derive mountains of Jewish knowledge. He was able to learn and be inspired with mountains of Jewish knowledge from every little crown. But when it says this about Rabbi Akiva, it doesn't call them crowns. It uses the kotz language, the thorns. On every thorn he was able to... Why do we use a negative language? We can call them tagin, ktarim. There's so many things that are called these little crowns, these little things. Why do we say that Rabbi Akiva was able to derive them, and we use a negative term, that he was able to derive them from the little thorns on the letter, from each thorn? And I once heard a beautiful thought, and it goes like this, that the Talmud is teaching us an amazing thing, that Rabbi Akiva was able, notwithstanding his terribly challenging life, I'll call kotz v'kotz. What's a thorn? A thorn pricks you, a thorn injures, a thorn hurts you. A thorn is a source of pain. And yet Rabbi Akiva was able to look beyond. He was able, on every thorn, he was able to derive mountains of Jewish knowledge, mountains of inspiration. That's what it means. Not just the thorns, the actual crowns. It means symbolically that Rabbi Akiva was the type of person that on every single thorn, on every single time of challenge, he was able to channel it. He was able to say, yes, it is painful. It's very painful, but I can look forward. But I can look for the meaning. I can look for the purpose. I can look for an opportunity, notwithstanding the pain. Not that the pain is good, and not that the pain is going to go away. But I can still find a way to find meaning. If my life is based on looking for meaning, I can, even in a situation like this, I can find it within me to stand up, to move forward, to look to the future, to find how can I turn this into something meaningful. Like I told you a few weeks ago, the first session we had on resilience, I told you the story that Rebbetzin at that conference that my wife went to spoke, right? And this is a perfect example of this, how she lost a child at birth a few days after they were born, right? And she had this tremendous hole. And then she was in an amazing display of resilience. She decided to give it meaning. And just to remind you, what she decided to do was, she came up with this amazingly deep idea that with every child is born another mother. That every time you have a child, you're born with a deeper motherly instinct. And although her child had died, but the mother in her hadn't. So she had to find a way to exercise, to use that mother that was now born within her. And therefore she went back to teaching, which she hadn't done for many, many years. And she educated thousands and thousands of students, all because she had decided to give up teaching, but then she decided to find meaning and purpose in her challenge. And she went and did something meaningful. Now again, we have to understand, not that the pain ever went away. Because when people talk about giving meaning to suffering, it doesn't mean to turn the suffering into something good. That's not what it means. Because suffering isn't good. And when a person loses someone so dear, a person who, like her, who lost a child, she still misses that child. Notwithstanding the child only lived a few days. It's still painful. But yet, she was able to bring amazing fulfillment to herself. With the suffering, she was able to discover amazing happiness. Because true happiness comes from meaning and purpose, not from things. And therefore, that fulfillment and the inner fulfillment that she was able to turn her whole life around from that story, to decide, to choose, to give meaning and purpose, and to take what she had discovered within her and to give it meaning and purpose, looking forward, what can I do tomorrow, the next day, to give it more meaning. She was able to come up with this thing to just educate thousands and thousands of children. She's a very, very good teacher, apparently. All because she had chosen that path of resilience. She had discovered the spark, and she had looked for the tomorrow, despite the pain, of how can I give meaning and purpose. Or that book I've shared with you in the last few weeks, that called The Broken Heart, The Blessing of the Broken Heart, by Sherry Mandel, who lost a child at 14, murdered by Arab terrorists, which was unbelievably traumatic. And she talks about the pain and describes the pain and describes the questions and the challenge and how she still lives with it. And nevertheless, she started this whole amazing organization. And again, an act of unbelievable resilience to help people. It doesn't have to be an amazing organization. It doesn't have to be a worldwide famous thing. I'm just giving you examples. It could be a little thing that we do every day. It can be just small things that we do every day, just to channel our energy, to channel our purpose, our focus into purpose and meaning, because purpose and meaning is the foundation of a person's life. And just to end off with going back to the destruction of the temple, I'll just share with you, just to encapsulate this concept, a fascinating Talmud, piece of Talmud. Just before the destruction of the second temple, the Sanhedrin, there's a whole story and I'm not going to go into now, but the high court, the Jewish high court, were relocated from the city of Jerusalem to the city of Yavne. And they were spared the actual destruction. They were living in Yavne at the time of the destruction of the temple. And on Tisha B'Av, on the saddest day of the Jewish year, on the 9th of Av, the day that the temple was destroyed, which was unknown to the people in Yavne because there was no communication in those days, a particular sage, and I forget his name, was living next door, one of the natives, one of the people living at the time. It says that in the Medrash it was an Aravi, an Arab. It doesn't mean an Arab like today. It means, I'm not sure what Arabs meant in those days. And suddenly, and this Arab had a cow. And this Arab was a sort of like a bit of a psyche guy, like a bit of a... And suddenly this cow gave a very loud, I don't know what you call it, loud moo, I suppose, right? Something like that. In Hebrew, ga'a paratosh l'arvi, the cow screamed. And this Arab turns to this great sage and says, your temple was just destroyed. I can tell. Your temple was just destroyed. And as he said that, the cow gave a second moo, second cry. And he turned to him and he said, oh, nolad mashi'an shel Yisrael. The savior of the Jewish people had just been born. In other words, the seeds of redemption have just been planted. And that sums up the whole concept. The cow mooed twice. Because the fact that the seeds of redemption had just been born didn't negate the first moo. It didn't negate the suffering of the destruction. But what he was telling the rabbi was, at the very same time, something negative happened. Stage one, painful, challenging, got to work through it. But then you also have to realize that at the very same second, or the next second, whatever the, however long that second will take, at the very next second, there's a ability to look forward, to work towards something in the future, to work towards a greater purpose, a higher meaning, something larger than ourselves. And the reason that it works is because, I've forgotten who it was, one great Jewish writer explains, and he says, the reason is because when we live our life only within ourselves for the benefit of our own physical pleasure, then we very much limited to ourselves. When we live a life of meaning and purpose, we're connected to something larger than ourselves, much greater than ourselves, infinitely greater than ourselves, and that gives us the ability to go beyond ourselves and to bounce back and to exercise resilience. So therefore, resilience has many components. But critical, one of the components has to be this concept of being able to look tomorrow, to look to the future, in order to bring, to turn what I am in now, despite the pain, despite the bad day that I had, on whatever level I'm experiencing resilience, despite the challenge that I'm experiencing, to know that there's a calling for me to look beyond and to bring meaning and purpose to my experience. Now, I want to just end off with two things. First of all, and I said in the beginning, just for the benefit of those who came late, this series will go for another 2 weeks. We still have a few more critical concepts of resilience to work through. In 3 weeks' time, on the 24th of March, it's Purim, which we'll still have a session. We'll have a special Purim discussion connected to the things we've been talking about, and have a bit of a morning tea, as we've done previously when Purim falls out on a Thursday. Also, I wanted to just mention, many of your husbands perhaps would have got an invitation to a fundraising Fabrengen that we're doing in a few weeks. The purpose of that is because we almost finished the renovations, and we just, although it was sponsored and mostly covered, we have a little gap still to fill. They will, in a few weeks after, we'll do actually a women's function as well. So I'm just mentioning that, first of all, if he didn't get the invitation, please tell me, because we'll make sure he does. And second of all, if he did get it, if you can push whoever it is to come and participate. However, I wanted to just offer you, if you've got a few minutes, those who are not rushing off perhaps, just to start joining in the excitement. If you've got a few minutes, why don't you come next door? Just don't bump into any walls because you get dirty. But if you come next door just to see how it's going along, it's actually getting quite exciting. It'll take another few weeks, but it's almost there. If you'd like to have a look, please come next door. Have a great week.